Shoppelmaniacs, welkom to a spooky October edition of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Blood Rupert, and with me is Chris Gravestone Coyer.
Are you planning to do this the whole month? You're
Ooh, you 30 days early,
buddy.
Yes, yeah. The whole month is spooky now.
I was thinking it'd be baller just to throw up New Year's decorations at the house. Be like, Happy New Year! Just punt on the rest of the year. Just pretend like we've already made it.
Well, and so much of it too, right? Like, what is Halloween this year? It's the holiday where kids go put their dirty hands into a bucket of candy where other kids put their dirty hands. That's not happening this year in 2020. I don't care. Like, no, maybe in your neighborhood, but I'm not abiding in that. So how does life, I don't know. The Halloween's different this year.
Well, You got to read the right blogs, man. People got ideas for this thing. I mean, the trunk thing was already big, but
trunk or treat. Yeah.
I suppose even that though, it doesn't necessarily solve the dirty candy problem necessarily, but I think people are already kind of self-segmenting into like close friend groups, and you probably rock that to some degree.
Just a little party, little hangout with the friends. I was thinking, I don't know if we could coordinate it, you know, but like maybe like a costume parade for the kids in the middle of the day or something, you know, just to,
yeah, you got to do the costumes. Like, come on.
Like, then it's like, you know, and I don't, but then it's like, we did a Halloween, we just did it in the middle of the day so that no one's tempted to go knock on doors and dig in candy bowls. So we did it very distant. We did it very safe, but anyway, we'll see. So,
yeah.
Hey.
Ruby's birthday is November 1st, you know, and it's literally on the day she was born, I'm like, oh man, she's going to like party so hard in college. And then at midnight when she's out at the bar, she's gonna be like, it's my birthday. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's just like a double rager energy.
Yeah. Double rager energy.
Oh, poor girl. She's got a future.
Well, today we woke up, it was October 1st, hence Dave's spooky intro, which also meant it's official garbage PR day, because this is Hacktober now. So welcome to getting weird PRs on all your repos where people change like one word. So it looks like they're contributing to open source so that they fucking get a t-shirt or whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of like the... like gamification of some cool thing happened, you know? And so now it's a less fun thing, you know? And it's not, you know, I'm dealing with an issue like right this minute, but just trying to figure it out. But it's just kind of like, how do we, I don't know, like it's cool, but like, it's actually kind of a burden to open source maintainers to have a sudden influx of interested parties. You know, it's like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I'm busy this October, not me specifically, but you know, it's like, I was actually busy. And so this increase in volume does not help me manage a open source repo, especially if it's just, I mean, maybe typos. It's like, okay, cool, typo. But I've seen some, and it's like, just like weird content edits and stuff like that. And so I don't know.
The content, that's all I've been seeing, is the like, I put some headers in your README, but I didn't, but it looks like I just guessed at some. And I got one that was like, this one's missing a README. So the README is going to contain the languages that GitHub suggests are in this repo, which I'm like, okay, that was automated. Good job. Yeah. Not useful. Yeah, it's pretty funny. I always have kind of two minds of this. You hear a lot of like over years and years, there's always big maintainers of big projects have a different particular level of stress that befalls them. You know, much better than I do, because you're a little better at maintaining open source things that people are actually interested in.
I'm good at spinning up things, less good at the maintaining.
But, you know, imagine you're Henry Zhu or whatever that we've had on the show. Like that's a big deal, right? And so, and they talk about the stresses that befall them. And I've always listened with some interest, you know, but the fact is they represent, you know, much less of the developer community than most of us. So you can't build you know, you can't make every decision at GitHub based on that, although you should help them. You know, I read one recently about vacation mode or something. Like some open source maintainer was like, if I go on vacation and ignore this, I'm signing myself up for pain. You know, not only will it be hard to vacation, but it will be hard to come back to the, you know, if I choose to ignore all of them, then what do I do when I come back and stuff? So should GitHub build vacation mode? That's where I'm like, there's nuance to this, you know, like if I'm a product owner, like we have enough technical debt over here, you know, to build this whole feature out for this one thing. I could see how that would be a no, even though it would clearly help this one person's life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So on open source, I have a commit, a really helpful, somebody was like, oh, lettering.js doesn't work with, there's other problems with lettering.js, but lettering.js doesn't work with I'm blanking, emoji, because you know how some emoji are combination emoji, like, you know, I don't know, girl plus astronaut is a female astronaut or whatever. Does that, are you familiar with how the Unicode staples them together with a non-breaking space?
I am.
It's kind of... So if you do like whatever
and female zero astronaut, width space, right, or something.
Yeah, zero width space joiner or something. So if you do like whatever female astronaut dot split, it'll actually split it into like three different things. So when lettering.js does splits, it like actually splits, you know, like every character.
Oh.
And so it was just eating emoji. It's a problem. And then somebody came in and asked a question and fixed it. But I haven't merged the PR, mostly like it's somewhat of a dead project, but I haven't merged the PR. Just because in my brain, I'm like, you know, I should write tests to make sure that this doesn't break something. And then somebody made a security patch, which again, like I should definitely care about, but I'm also like, I should have tests so that like I'm not just whatever approving PRs because somebody's like, hey, I want emoji, you know, or whatever. Like
oh, I get it, because sure you want to press something. That button. There's a button that just says, you know, merge and approve or whatever, and it's tempting to just press it, but you're like, this is actually changing code. That button wouldn't be there if there wasn't actual change, actual code, actual changing. So how do you absolutely know that it's not going to break something? Well, you'll never know entirely, but at least you can write tests for the very most important functionality and make sure that that stuff doesn't break. So you're probably right to do that, but it is tricky because sometimes, you know, oftentimes it's just some bump to Lodash or something. And you're like, I don't know. And sometimes it comes from GitHub itself. You know, they like have this little bot that
suggests stuff. Well, and the like security one, it's actually like, I understand the fix, but I'm also like, did I intentionally make it insecure? I know that sounds stupid, but it was like, was there another request that wanted it insecure? So I had to like work around something. And not that I like am like pro insecurity, but I'm just like, I don't even remember what had happened or why, you know? So, and it's like only if you're like running lettering on content injection, like injected content. Okay. So like very kind of, again, like limited use case, hopefully, but like, hopefully you're just not allowing like script tags in your input fields anyway. But this should also not like process script tags or whatever. So, but the fix was like, it actually converted a whole bunch of jQuery stuff to, like vanilla JavaScript, and that's fine. That's fine. But I was just like, oh, can you just do this with like JavaScript or jQuery? Like, you know, do the EQ zero instead of like, you know, getting the like raw JavaScript object or whatever. I just was like, I think I can do this without, in a very easier impact. But again, it's like, I have to like have time. I have to have, like patience. I have to write tests. Like there's kind of a lot more to it in my brain than just like hitting a green button approve. So I just, that's where, again, being an open source maintainer is hard. I almost wish like there are more people who are like, hey, I'm gonna, can I help you maintain a project better? Wouldn't that be a cool like PR thing? Like, hey, I'm gonna get you set up on some basic tests. That's the one first thing I want to do. Hey, I want to like figure out your deployment, your versioning. I'm gonna help you get a little thing going here. You know, that's helpful. That's help, you know.
That is helpful. I think that's fair to answer that. Just be like, listen, I have no mental space for this. The reason that I'm not merging this is because I have concerns that I can't just be hitting this green button on PRs without tests. So I'm just going to leave this open for, say, 6 months. If the tests arrive in that time, whether I write them or somebody else does, cool. And if they don't arrive, I'm going to close the PR, you know. But even that, even typing those words requires some bandwidth and time and patience and mental space that you might just not have, because it's very legit to just be like, you know what, I literally just don't care. I care so little that I'm just going to hit archive on this email and just not even think about it, because that's the amount of mental space I have for this right now.
No, I mean, it's tough stuff.
Yeah.
So,
or I might log in and delete the damn repo because I'm sick of these emails, you know.
That's extreme, but but that's even too, like, how do you, like, you know, I know you can transfer ownership, and I'm actually very comfortable with the, like, you don't like how I'm managing it, fork it and use your thing.
Yeah,
you know, like, just fork it, please. Like,
I think big business, that's this. Pretty common. I've done that at least half a dozen times at CodePen, where we didn't even consider doing it any other way. Because it's like, this is obviously a change that's just for us. We'll just have the fork. It's like, especially because it's not particularly difficult then to occasionally pull master into your fork. Or not master, but you know what I mean? Whatever their canonical thing is.
Yeah, the like main upstream branch.
Upstream, there you go. Okay, well, that's cool. Hey, I got an interesting email that I almost felt like wasn't really worth a blog post, but was interesting, like quick mouth blog kind of thing. Is somebody showed me the screenshot of some copy on the web, right? And it was like in a contact page or something, and said, blah blah blah, contact us, please fill out the form at the right, and blah blah blah. And they had, like, in the screenshot, they like triple circled the word on the right, because on the right, it, as we know in the world of responsive design, is like often wrong. You know, like, when is it on the right? It's on the right sometimes. It's not on the right on mobile, you know, and they are just curious at like how you know, what do you do in situations like that? Do you have a span that you swap out that says below then? Or how do you, and they called it wayfinding, which I think is an appropriate term, you know, helping people know what you're talking about. What do you do? Do you just like very carefully avoid language like that, or?
Yeah, no, I mean, sometimes it's like fill out the form above or below, you know, or something, you know, and it's suddenly not below, you know. If you can like figure out verbiage that isn't so directional, you know, I think that's smart. You know, because LTR would also be a problem there too, you know, stacking would be a problem there too. Or RTL.
Yeah.
So like Hebrew or something.
Do you think would catch yourself, or have you ever made a mistake like that? Or do you kind of like, I'm just curious what your brain does when you're about to write a sentence like that, like you, Dave Rupert, you know, like, do you think you would catch yourself, or do you think you would screw it up?
I think I would catch myself. And I think I catch myself even when it's like click here, because guess what? We don't always click, you know, like you tap. That's probably the most normal, you know, but in like, you could probably say like click and tap are the sort of same thing. But you know, whenever I like write, okay, click this button or whatever, click the button in the form or whatever, you know, I'm immediately like, ooh, that's probably not, I don't know. It's just kind of like dated content, if that makes sense. Like I'm old. I'd say click, you know, like that's old.
Yeah, kind of.
That's what old people say is click. So I don't know. So I think we've like tried to update it, hip it up to like tap the icon or whatever. But like,
even that is really, you know, like, I don't know if that feels right to me either.
Well, but you know, and hopefully it just makes sense, you know, that's the, you know, you just.
I think click makes sense, but it's, but it, you're right that it doesn't come off real good. Maybe hit, although hit's kind of a little loaded too.
Yeah, no, I think I've just, there's some sort of like, you know, I think too, like if you like, have you ever been to one of those websites with coach marks or whatever, you know, where it overlays things. And then like it, you go to the responsive view and all of a sudden those little arrows for the coach marks aren't pointing in the right direction.
Sure. Anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
That's something you got to think about. You know?
Yeah. We use app cues now at CodePen and I'm kind of, I'm impressed by the product. I think they do a good job and theirs is very, fancy, you know, like it, you give it anchor elements and it does what it needs to do to position them based on the ID of the thing that it's looking for. And, so it hardly ever screws that up, but it is an easy thing to screw up if you're not, you know, invested in that. But we go so far as we don't even load that script on mobile. Cause it's like, mobile's just going to be a totally different ball game. The tool really isn't built to work like that. As one of the reasons we chose it is kind of desktop first, like CodePen is. Now, feel free to slap our wrists for that, but I happen to have an inside look at our analytics, and even after all these years, it's 99% desktop. So sorry,
right? It's not exactly a mobile workspace, but yeah, I mean, occasionally I'll challenge myself to write a CodePen on my phone, but
yeah, well,
that would be a That would be awesome. Code.
That's why
phone
it's not
challenge.
Chicken or the egg, because it's like it's not 99% because we offer no mobile support at all. In fact, we've bent over backwards to make that work over time. And still, the statistics are like that.
Yeah. But it is a nice to have, like when I'm visiting a CodePen, or, you know, because I check my phone at night, you know, like, and I see cool CodePens or whatever. So it's like it's always nice to have access, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like I'm not dumped into a giant website, you know, experience. So I can like kind of poke around at the code, but you know, even that, I think that's just the form factor's hard. The keyboard typing on the keyboard's hard. It's not necessarily CodePen problems. It's more like visual real estate plus keyboard problems.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Framer, literally framer.com/shoptalk. Go there to get to sign up for free or to get 20% off if you go for any of their paid plans, which is super cool. Thanks, Framer. So good design work, you know, it should clearly communicate a message. The same is true for you, a designer. You should be clearly communicating a message. To who? To the people you need to sign off on your design, your manager, your client, your CEO, you know? So why are you still presenting flat, lifeless product ideas? Put an interactive prototype into the hands of those people and watch their eyes light up and they'll buy into your vision. You know, it's much more convincing to present an interactive prototype. Framer is your secret weapon. Start from scratch or import work from another design tool, drag and drop, you know, build these powerful interactive components, set up transitions, animations, you know, which is like almost expected these days that your app has when it's moving from one page to the next or in one state to another state, that it has transitions to get you there. Create your own stunning animations, all visually. It's a web app, you know, beautiful for it. Rich, realistic prototyping just became intuitive in Framer. Just take it from Bruno, a product designer at Shutterstock. Framer is an extraordinary resource for rapid prototyping. It has improved our team collaboration by providing an easy way to share the designs between engineers and project managers. Its built-in tools have been essential for quick prototyping and user testing. Oh, how awesome is that? Again, that's framer.com/shoptalk, where you can sign up for free or get 20% off any of their paid plans.
Let's do a few questions. People wrote in some interesting ones here. Here's a little quickie from Bill Luce. Would our industry still be convinced that SPAs were the best thing to do if we had to pay for the frameworks that made them possible? Been thinking about how different everything would be if we had to pay for our dependencies. But don't you pay, Bill? Don't you pay in technical debt and
blood,
performance?
Sweat, and tears. You know, I mean, so, yeah, I think this would be different. I mean, like, you know, Microsoft in the 2000s had .NET framework and you paid to get that, you know, like you pay enterprise licenses. I mean, shoot, like NetBeans, you pay for that, you know, like these frameworks, you know, like frameworks that you pay for, it totally exist. And like, it's great business model, but it's also like very like you are locked in, you know, Unity, there's a free edition, but you actually pay if you like get big enough, you know, like there's in other ecosystems, there's pay to play setups. Right. But, and it would look very different, you know, what I like about the Vue community is they're very transparent about like, hey, pay to support this, or like I've always said this, but like their community support, like ethos or whatever, is very like contributor positive. Maybe is that a way to put it? But they're very like, hey, this is how this lives, support it. So I like that, but yeah, it would be different. Every time you install Lodash, you had to chuck a buck. That'd be different. So.
Yeah, that's and there's just too much of it for that, right? Like, not that the world can't change, but there's just not. You'd be moving mountains to have that kind of impact, especially in the, you know, now that NPM exists, for example, and there's millions of things on there. To have a model that says, "Well, I have a thing too. You have to install it in a different way, and it costs a dollar." Yeah, good luck, you know. And then how do you prove the quality of that thing? Now you see it in design a little bit because it's easy to prove the quality of it. So there's Kendo React or whatever, and there's Tailwind UI, and there's things that's like, hey, look, see how good this is? Give us $100, and then you get it because you can see it is. But I don't know how good your Lodash alternative is. I can't see the code until I buy it. What?
Yeah, no, it'd be different. It would have to be very convincing, you know, like in some ways open source is one out, you know. It's interesting Bill like ties like funding to like single page app frameworks and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it could be any project, not just specifically like React apps or whatever. But, you know, if you had to pay for React router or something, you know, it would probably be a different world, you know. I mean,
and I'm not sure, poo-pooing like, on it. I don't write code ever that doesn't have a clear way to monetize it. I'm not an altruistic coder. I don't ever do anything if I'm not haven't entrepreneurialized it at least a little bit, or at least I believe that it's in service to other things that I do that make money. So I'm all about it.
Well, I mean, like David DeSandro is a great example. Charges for masonry, charges for what's his new one? Fizzy? No, that's his company, Metafizzy. His new
he must have a dozen thing. Of them. Oh, yeah. The slider isn't particularly new, is it? Is that what is that one?
Newish.
I love that.
In the last decade.
sure.
I'll find it here. But anyway, here we go. But he isotope is one Flickity. That's it. Yeah. Flickity. Flickity. You know, he charges for that. And I think he has like a, hey, you can use this on your personal site license, like whatever. But if you're like a company and you want to use it, like, and this is a perfect example where like, for me, it's worth it to pay for this because it's like, I know he's put effort into it. I know like a responsive carousel is kind of a hard thing to solve, like in a good way. I know he's like chucked some attention at accessibility. Is it perfectly accessible? I don't know, but like he's at least tried, I think, to some degree. And you know, so is it worth money to me? It is. You know, but does it have as many downloads as React Slider?
No,
you know,
yeah.
Probably not. So, you know, so yeah, I mean, I think
love Dave. We should get him on the show to talk about this because I bet he's just steeped in thoughts on this kind of stuff because, you know, And I know that he thinks about the economics of it heavily too, because, you know, as you might know about Dave, Dave's got another job. This isn't Dave's job. You'd think it would be, because he's got, it's not just one of these things. He's been entrepreneurial doing all kinds of stuff. He sells logos. He sells, you know.
That's the best thing he does. He'll make like 20 logos in a day or something. I don't know.
It's yeah, month, and then be like,
but then he'll sell each one, like, yeah, and it goes up in cost or something. Or
yeah, it's great. It's, and then he does free stuff too. So that's like, it's like impossible not to run across Dave's work, and yet it's not enough. It's not enough to do the family thing. So you're like, if Dave can't do it, who the hell can?
Yeah. Well, and that's where, you know, big money, like corporations doing open source comes in.
Yeah. You know? I bet if he just made Flickity and he just put the word React at the top, he'd probably double his money.
Maybe. Well, and you think about like 11D, I know they have like an open collective kind of thing going on. Maybe some corporate sponsors, you know.
Yeah. Zach Leatherman, but, employed, you know.
Yeah, employed. Yeah. So I, you know, maybe one day he'd be able to 11D full time, but like that's, you know, that's a lot of ways off. And there's probably even, he probably likes his day job, you know, and maybe the first hire is actually somebody to do community or something, or triage bugs for him or something, you know, like.
Oh, I see. Might, stay employed and hire somebody anyway. Oh, clever.
You know, I mean, like, that's what I would consider. Yeah, right? Like, oh, shoot. Like, I could pay somebody to merge down this emoji PR. I'll just do that. Like, cause I don't have the brain space to switch over to that, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. The cost of switching too, isn't that a classic? And you always think of Sophie when you think of that.
Yeah. Sophie Shepard, her like context switching, cause she was trying to do code and managing and, you know, or even just going from meetings to like one-on-ones, and it just was burning her out. And so she just, and I felt that too. Just you go from project one to project two to project three, and you're just like, dude, I don't even know. So I don't know where I'm at. Yeah. Now.
I think so. It gives you some strength to some degree, but at a really high cost. Like, I mean, tell me if you can switch between a, you know, a front end and a back end project in very different languages and a very different folder structure and yada, 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 and just instantly be able to work. I mean, that's a serious, you're good, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, I even had an experience like recently. I was like doing that. I was like I'm operating, dude. I'm going. And then like, Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon hit, and it was just like, oh man, I don't got it. No gas in the tank. The brain's dead. Like I can't do it. So you can like just suddenly run out of energy if there's like one hiccup or one twist, you know? So, oh well.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Imagix. That's imgix.com. It's a powerful image and processing API. And I'm going to get into it and explain it. I think it's a fantastic product. I asked them once how you pronounce it, and I have it right. So this is podcast friendly. Imagix.com. Like I said, fantastic product. Let me set the stage for you a little bit, though. I've been into, you know, we talk about build processes sometimes on the site. You could, for example, make sure that your build process optimizes all your images. So by the time that they're up on your web server and they're being served to people, they're optimized. That's one of the things you need to do. I don't think it's optional either. You have to be serving your images in an optimized format. And sure, okay, you can do that yourself. But I always feel like if I do it myself, it's limited compared to what a company who's absolutely focused on this job can do. And then it's not just the optimizing it, but it's like the serving it in the correct format and the being able to manipulate it in different situations. So let me talk about that a little bit more. For example, well, how you set up Imagix is like this. You know, you have like a master location of where your images are. Maybe it's your web server, and it doesn't matter that much. I don't think you need to like pre-CDN your images, because what Imagix does is it sits in front of your master images as the global CDN, which is fantastic anyway, because you need a global CDN for your images if you want your site to be fast and responsible. In fact, Lighthouse will ding you for it if it's not, you know? So if you're going for those good scores, that's important. Maybe it's an S3 bucket. That's a common way. That's the way I've worked with ImageX before. That's your master location. And then you have these URLs that are like yourdomain.imagex.com. And then what you have then is the ability to add query parameters that's like, I want it served in this size. I want it to be automatically compressed the best that you possibly can. And let's say I change the aspect ratio. I want you to crop it. I want you to crop it towards this focal point. I want you to blur it. I want you to make it black and white. I want you to combine it with this other image. It has all these powerful possibilities while being served from a global CDN. So like you wouldn't even need to put this stuff in your build process because you could just make your, you know, the images that you upload in dev or while you blog or whatever be the master images that are just huge, unoptimized, just source images, which I think is kind of nice because then you're not ruining your source image. And then because you're serving them through ImageX, they're optimized in the best possible way. They're served in the best possible format. We did challenges at CodePen where we did 4 weekly challenges that kind of dug into those things. For example, the picture element is one of them. You know how you want to serve responsive images and do fancy art direction kind of stuff, then you could use ImageX, and then just all you have to do is change the query parameter of the master image to be like, well, I want it at this size at this particular breakpoint and this size at this particular breakpoint. You can be fancy and just have one master image. You're not hand making all these images. It's the way to go. Thanks so much for the sponsorship, ImageX.
Make sure you visit imagex.com/shoptalk and sign up to receive a $300 account credit.
Here's Jesse Gundy, who's asking. He's like a decade-long front-end developer, you know, whatever. We have his little short version of his life story here. But the important thing is, Jesse says, I don't like social media. I've gotten off it, personally. I'm wondering, what are the best ways to promote my projects without relying directly on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc.? I know there are aggregation sites out there, always looking for fun things to share. Any suggestions on how to get your stuff out there without creating a bunch of accounts yourself?
Man, this is tough. I saw this question come in when I thought about it for a good long while, and I have nothing to say because I like social media is very much like the broadcast channel. You know, I can blog on my RSS and 8.5 people will see it, but you know, I could submit it to Product Hunt, or is that what it's called? Product Hunt.
Yeah.
And you know,
that's one day of glory.
Yeah. I'm going to get, 8 thumbs up and one day of glory. I can, like, whatever, crash Hacker News, I'll get downvoted. I can post on Reddit or something. You know, no one's going to. It's tough without some, like, kind of broadcast channel. And even, like, now that all those channels are algorithmic, too, like, you kind of have to be involved because you get rewarded for involvement, I think. I don't think you can just show up and be like, I haven't tweeted in 5 years, so here you go. You know, here's a new project. You know, I don't think it always works like that. You can get lost in the stream of content. So I don't know. You can do a blog. What are your thoughts? I have nothing.
Well, yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky, but I would also say, I mean, that to me, that paints the picture as, well, Jesse, you're going to have to get over yourself and get some social media accounts because it's the only way. But I'd like to tear that wall down. And for example, on all the projects I work on, I mean, here I have CSS Tricks, Google Analytics open right now, combined for all social media incoming it's a little over 1%, but we're talking 1%. So
oh, wow.
I don't care about social media and CSS Tricks. It doesn't work for us. It doesn't do anything for us. There's some immediate impact sometimes. For example, with something that's really like, you know, an instant Slurpee, like we have a Flexbox poster for sale. You tweet it, you probably get a couple sales, right? That's good. but you can't, it's not repeatable. I can't do it every hour. Otherwise it doesn't work anymore. So it's just this little hit to remind people. And maybe if you're lucky, the other day, somebody else tweeted about our Flexbox poster and I just inexplicably, it got like 4,000 likes by people and it just kind of exploded. And we made some sales from that, but not like we didn't make 1,000 sales. You know, you always make some tiny percent of it. I don't even know if we made 100, you know, but it may have been something like that. Probably less though, but that's awesome. Wow. A little social media snowball moment. Cool. That's not going to happen again. It's not something you can rely on. It's just, that was nice. So, you know, but social, that didn't require us doing anything. That was other people's social media. So you don't necessarily need your own for that. It just needs to be something shareable. But this year, and I know this is coming up on, well, we're clearly in October now, as of January 1st, I just started to just ignore our social media on CSS Tricks. I was like, in past years, I would wake up and I would consider it a job. I'd fill a little queue. I'd use Buffer to like queue up tweets so they'd sprinkle out throughout the day. You know, like, oh, isn't that what publications do? They sprinkle out their social media messaging over time. And I was just like, I just don't care anymore. I can't look at traffic reports that tell me that 1% of our traffic come from social media and spend all day on this. That's a crazy man's errand. It's not a good idea. So I just didn't. But what I did do is I set up automation. So when you hit the publish button on CSS Tricks, it automatically gets tweeted. And if we want to write a nice message in there, you can. You know, the social media card comes from the featured image on the post and all that. And it's just a soapbox. It's an outgoing soapbox of what we publish. And you know how much social media traffic we have? The same as last year. It's the same. So it's like, it just doesn't matter. And the CodePen social media story is not that different. I mean, maybe we get the traffic numbers are higher, so the percentages might even be lower. I think it's nice to be there. I, you know, to some degree, although just as ever, less and less happy with Twitter leadership. I was so upset reading that Coinbase freaking article. I thought that was so bad. And I'm still processing how I feel about it. And then to scroll down to the bottom and have Williams down there just being like, good, you know, and you're just like, that is so gross, you piece of shit. Anyway.
No, it's, I think like, I like Jesse's, like, I'm not going to social media. Like, I actually admire that. But unfortunately, if like you take that out of the equation, I'm less like, I don't know the correct way to like, whatever, boost your products or your side projects and stuff like that. The only way I can think of is like, you are involved in the communities that project is trying to serve.
There you go.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, so you don't, whatever, you don't boost, you're trying to boost your traffic from CodePen social media. But you're involved in the CodePen community or the, CodePen's, but let's say go take a step back. Like you don't boost the traffic to CodePen from the CSS tricks, but you're involved in the CSS sort of community. And so like the tie-in happens through that, right? Like, so I guess it would depend on, like, I made a drawing app, right, called Prompts. It's like an Inktober thing. It's cool. I like it. It's a very fun toy for me. And I guess I maybe need to update it for this year's Inktober. Shoot, I have more open source to do. dang it. But like, you know, I'm not heavily involved in the Inktober community. So maybe it's not a thing I should do. I'm not a super drawer. This is more to like help me draw more, you know? So maybe I'm the totally wrong freaking person and the idea is already dead in the water because I'm not really active in that community at all. And whatever that community means, you know, is it making YouTubes, commenting on YouTubes? Is it you know,
it's hard to put a point on, but you'll know if you're a known drawer. You'll have drawer friends. You'll read drawing news. You'll post your drawings. I mean, I know it's hard to put a point on, but I think you'll know it and other people know it if you're a drawer.
Yeah. And so like, and if I was in that, if I was a drawer and I was involved in the drawing space, man, this app would be very popular. not really, but like, you know, it's like, it's that thing. It's like, if you had something, if you're in that community, then I think you'll have more success. But, and so whatever that looks like, it doesn't have to be social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, but, you know, maybe you find out where the community exists, you know? So
I think that's great too. I have a final thought on this too, is that I have a working theory here that really good products and really good writing, really good apps, really good drawings don't go unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
The world is too connected for that. If there's an absolutely incredibly written blog post about X, it will get seen. It will get its day in the sun. It will get, there's not blogs out there of developers writing about technology incredibly well that just have dust bunnies on them because they get one view a month. It just doesn't happen. It's a quality thing too. So if you make something, if you have some product, Jesse, right?
Yep.
That's amazingly well done. It's going to do okay. You don't need Twitter to make sure that that happens, you know?
No, there's some security or whatever in like, you know, if you're producing something good, it'll appeal to the right people and it'll find the right people. And, you know, so yeah, who will make nice things on your thing. So.
Sure. So do you have any thoughts rattling around in your head here? We are at the end of the show, we are going to invite our friend Jeremy Keith back to the end here to read part two of Jay Hoffman's web history series. And it's just so lovely that Jeremy was able to do this for us. So I think you're going to enjoy it.
Yeah. I appreciate both of them like giving time in writing and then reading this stuff. So it's really cool. And I don't have anything, so we can just cut over to that if you want.
Sure. Let's do it.
Dennis Ritchie had a problem. He was working on a new world-class operating system. He and a few other colleagues were building it from the ground up to be simple and clean and versatile. It needed to run anywhere, and it needed to be fast. Ritchie worked at Bell Labs, a hotbed of innovation in the 60s and 70s. Bell employed some of the greatest minds in telecommunications. While there, Ritchie had worked on a time-sharing project known as Multics. He was fiercely passionate about what he saw as the future of computing. Still, after years of development and little to show for it, Bell eventually dropped the project. But Ritchie and a few of his colleagues refused to let the dream go. They transformed Multics into a new operating system adaptable and extendable enough to be used for networked time sharing. They called it Unix. Ritchie's problem was with Unix's software. More precisely, his problem was with the language the software ran on. He had been writing most of Unix in assembly code, quite literally feeding paper tape into the computer, the way it was done in the earliest days of computing. Programming directly in assembly, being close to the metal as some programmers referred to it, made Unix blazing fast and memory efficient. The process, on the other hand, was laborious and prone to errors. Ritchie's other option was to use B, an interpreted programming language developed by his co-worker Ken Thompson. B was much simpler to code with, several steps abstracted from the bare metal. However, it lacked features Ritchie felt were crucial. B also suffered under the weight of its own design. It was slow to execute and lacked the resilience needed for time-sharing environments. Ritchie's solution was to choose neither. Instead, he created a compiled programming language with many of the same features as B, but with more access to the kind of things you could expect from assembly code. That language is called C. By the time Unix shipped, it had been fully rewritten in C, and the programming language came bundled in every operating system that ran on top of it, which, as it turned out, was a lot of them. As more programmers tried C, they adapted to it quickly. It blended, as some might say, perfectly abstract functions and methods for creating predictable software patterns with the ability to get right down to the metal if needed. It isn't prescriptive, but it doesn't leave you completely lost. Saronyat Barak, host of the Command Heroes podcast, described C as a nearly universal tool for programming, just as capable on a personal computer as it was on a supercomputer. C has been called a Swiss Army language. There is very little it can't do, and very little that hasn't been done with it. Computer scientist Bill Daly once said, "It set the tone for the way that programming was done for several decades." And that's true. Many of the programming paradigms developed in the latter half of the 20th century originated in C. Compilers were developed beyond Unix, available in every operating system. Rob Pike, a software engineer involved in the development of Unix and later Go, has a much simpler way of putting it. C is a desert island language. Ritchie has a saying of his own he is fond of repeating. C has all of the elegance and power of assembly language, with all the readability and maintainability of assembly language. C is not necessarily everyone's favorite programming language, and there are plenty of problems with it. C Sharp, created in the early 2000s, was one of many attempts to improve it. However, as it proliferated out into the world, bundled in Unix-like operating systems like X-Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X, software developers turned to it as a way to speak to one another. It became a kind of common tongue. Even if you weren't fluent, you could probably understand the language conversationally. If you needed to bundle up and share some code, C was a great way to do it. In 1993, Jean-François Groff and Sir Tim Berners-Lee had to release a package with all of the technologies of the web. It could be used to build web servers or browsers. They called it libwww and released it to the public domain. It was written in C. Think about the first time you browsed the web, that first web page. Maybe it was a rich experience filled with images, careful design, and content you couldn't find anywhere else. Maybe it was unadorned, uninteresting, and brief. No matter what that page was, I'd be willing to bet that it had some links. And when you clicked that link, there was magic. Suddenly a fresh page arrives on your screen. You are now surfing the web, and in that moment, you understand what the web is. Sir Tim Berners-Lee finished writing the first web browser, World Wide Web, in the final days of 1990. It ran on his next machine and had read and write capabilities, the latter of which could be used to manage a home page on the web. The next cube wasn't the heaviest computer you've ever seen, but it was still a desktop. That didn't stop Berners-Lee from lugging it from conference to conference so he could plug it in and show people the web. Again and again he ran into the same problem. It will seem obvious to us now when considering the difficulty of demonstrating a globally networked hypertext application running on a little-used operating system, next, on a not-widely-owned computer, next computer system, alone at a conference without the internet. The problem came after the demo with the inevitable question, how can I start using it? The web lacks its magic if you can't connect to the network yourself. It's entirely useless isolated on a single computer. To make the idea click, Berners-Lee needed to get everybody surfing the web, and he couldn't very well lend his computer out to anybody that wanted to use it. That's where Nicola Pello came in. An undergraduate at Leicester Polytechnic, Pello was still an intern at CERN. She was assigned to Berners-Lee's and Caillou's team, so they tasked her with building an interoperable browser that could be installed anywhere. The fact that she had no background in programming, she was studying mathematics, and that she was at CERN as part of an internship didn't concern her much. Within a couple of months, she had picked up a bit of C programming and built the Line Mode browser. Using the Line Mode browser today, you would probably feel like a hacker from the 1980s. It was a text-only browser designed to run from a command line terminal. In most cases, just plain white text on a black background, pixels bleeding from edge to edge. Typing out a web address into the browser would bring up that website's text on a screen. The up and down arrows on a keyboard could be used for navigation. Links were visible as a numbered list, and one could jump from site to site by entering the right number. It was designed that way for a reason. Its simplicity guaranteed interoperability. The Line Mode browser holds the unique distinction of being the only browser for many years to be platform agnostic. It could be installed anywhere, on just about any computer or operating system. It made getting online easy, provided you knew what to do once you installed it. Pello left CERN a few months after she released the Line Mode browser. She returned after graduation and helped build the first Mac browser. Almost as soon as Pello left, Berners-Lee and Caillou wrangled another recruit. Jean-François Groff was working at CERN one office over. A programmer for years, Groff had written the French translation of the official C programming guide by Brian Kerningham and the language's creator, Dennis Ritchie. He was working on a bit of physics software for Unix systems when he got a chance to see what Berners-Lee was working on. Not everybody understood what the web was going for. It can be difficult to grasp without the worldwide picture we have today. Groff was not one of those people. He longed for something just like the web. He understood perfectly what the web could be. Almost as soon as he saw a demo, he requested a transfer to the team. He noticed one problem right away. "So this line mode browser, it was a bit of a chicken and egg problem," he once described in an interview. "Because to use it, you had to download the software first and install it, and possibly compile it. You had to use the web to download a web browser, but you needed a web browser to use the web." Groff found a clever solution. He built a simple mechanism that allowed users to telnet into the next server and browse the web using its built-in line mode browser, so anyone in the world could remotely access the web without even needing to install the browser. Once they were able to look around, Groff hoped, they'd be hooked. But Groff wanted to take it one step further. He came from Unix systems and C programming. C is a desert island language. Its versatility makes it invaluable as a one-size-fits-all solution. Groff wanted the web to be a desert island platform. He wanted it to be used in ways that he hadn't even imagined yet, ways that scientists at research institutions couldn't even fathom. The one medium you could do anything with. To do that, he would need to make the web far more portable. Working alongside Berners-Lee, Groff began pulling out the essential elements of the next browser and porting them to the C programming language. Groff chose C not only because he was familiar with it, but because he knew most other programmers would be as well. Within a few months, he'd built the libwww package. Its official title would come a couple of years later. The libwww package was a set of common components for making graphical browsers. Included was the necessary code for parsing HTML, processing HTTP requests, and rendering pages. It also provided a starting point for creating browser UI and tools for embedding browser history and managing graphical windows. Berners-Lee announced the web to the public for the first time on August 7, 1991. He posted a brief description along with a simple note. Quote, "If you're interested in using the code, mail me. It's very prototype, but available by anonymous FTP from info.cern.ch. It's copyright CERN, but free distribution and use is not normally a problem." End quote. If you were to email Sir Tim Berners-Lee, he'd send you back the libwww package. By November of 1992, the library had fully matured into a set of reusable tools. When CERN put the web in the public domain the following year, its terms included the libwww package. By 1993, anyone with a bit of time on their hands and a C compiler could create their own browser. Before he left CERN to become one of the first web consultants, Groff did one final thing. He created a new mailing list called WWW Talk for a new generation of browser developers to talk shop. On December 13, 1991, almost a year after Berners-Lee had put the finishing touches on the first ever browser, Pei-Yuan-Wei posted to the WWW Talk mailing list. After a conversation with Berners-Lee, he had built a browser called Viola WWW. In a few months, it would be the most popular of the early browsers. In the middle of his post, Wei offhandedly, in a tone that would come off as bragging if it weren't so sincere, mentioned that the browser build was a one-night hack. A one-night hack. Not even Berners-Lee or Pello could pull that off. Wei continued the post with the reasons he was able to get it up and running so quickly, but that nuance would be lost to history. What programmers would remember is that it only took one day to build a browser. It was hacked together and shipped to the world, buggy but usable. That phrase would set the tone and pace of browser development for at least the next decade. It is arguably the dominant ideology among browser makers today. The irony is that the opposite was true. Viola WWW was the product of years of work that simply culminated in a single night. Wei is a great software programmer, but he also had all the pieces he needed before the night even started. Pei Yuanwei has made a few appearances on the front lines of web history. Apart from the Viola www browser, he was hired by Dale Doherty to work on an early version of GNN.com, the first commercial website. He was at a meeting of web pioneers the day the idea of the W3C was first discussed. In 2012, he was on the list of witnesses to speak in court to the many dangers of the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA. In the web's early history, Wei was a persistent presence. Wei was a student at UC Berkeley in the early 90s. It was HyperCard that set off his fascination with hypertext software. HyperCard was an application built for the Mac operating system in the late 80s. It allowed its users to create stacks of virtual cards, each with a little bit of info. Users could then connect these cards however they wanted and quickly sort, search, and navigate through their stacks. People used it to organize their recipes, replace their Rolodexes, organize research notes, and a million other things. HyperCard is the kind of software that attracts a person who demands a certain level of digital meticulousness, the kind of user that organizes their desktop folders into neat sections and precisely tags their data. This core group of power users manipulated the software using its built-in scripting language, HyperScript, to extend it to new heights. Wei had just glimpsed HyperCard before he knew he needed to use it, but he was on an ex-Windows computer, and HyperCard could only run on a Mac. Wei was not to be deterred. Instead of buying a Mac computer, an expensive but reasonable solution to the problem, Wei began to write software of his own. He even went one step further. Wei began by creating his very own programming language. He called it Viola, and the first thing he built with it was a HyperCard clone. Wei felt that the biggest limitation of HyperCard, and by extension his own hypertext software, was that it lacked access to a network. What good was data if it was locked up inside of a single computer? By the time he had reached that conclusion, it was nearing the end of 1991, around the time he saw a mention of the World Wide Web. So one night he took Viola, combined it with libwww, and built a web browser. Viola www was officially released. Viola www was built so quickly because most of it was already done by the time Wei found out about the web project. The Viola programming language was in the works for a couple of years at that point. It had already been built to accept hyperlinks and hypermedia for the HyperCard clone. It had been built to be extendable to other possible applications. Once Wei was able to pick apart libwww, he ported his software to read HTML, which itself was still a preposterously simple language. That piece, the final tip of the iceberg, only took him a single night. Viola www would be the site of a lot of experimentation on the early web. Wei was the first to include an early version of style sheets. He added a bookmarking function. The browser supported forms and embedded media. In a prescient move, Wei also included downloadable applets, allowing fairly advanced applications running inside of the browser. This became the template for what would eventually become Java applets. For ex-Windows users, Viola www was the most popular browser on the market. Until the next thing came along. Releasing a browser in the early 90s was almost a rite of passage. There was a useful exercise in downloading the libwww package and opening it up in your text editor. The web wasn't all that complicated. There was a bit of code for rendering HTML and processing HTTP requests from web servers, or other origins like FTP or Gopher. Programmers of the web used a browser project as a way of getting familiar with its features. It was kind of like the Hello World of the early web. In June of 1993, there were 130 websites in the entire world. There was easily a dozen browsers to choose from. That's roughly one browser for every 10 websites. This rapid development of browsers was driven by the nature of innovation in the web community. When Berners-Lee put the web in the public domain, he did more than just give it to the world. He put openness at the center of its ideology. It would take 5 years, with the release of Netscape, for the web to get its first commercial browser. Until then, the browser makers were a small community of programmers talking things out on the WWW Talk mailing list, trying to make web browsing feel as revolutionary as they wanted it to be. Some of the earliest projects ported one browser to another operating system. Occasionally, one of the browser makers would spontaneously release something that now feels essential. The first PDF rendering inside of a browser window was part of the Midas browser. HTML tables were introduced and properly laid out in another called Arena. Tabbed browsing was a prominent feature in InternetWorks. All of these features were developed before 1995. Most early browsers have faded into obscurity, but the people behind them didn't. Counted among the earliest browser makers are future employees at Netscape, members of the W3C and the Web Standards Movement, the inventor of cookies and the blink tag, and the creators of some of the most important websites of the early web. Of course, no one knew that at the time. To most of the creators, it was simply an exercise in making something cool they could pass along to their internet friends. The New York Times introduced its readers to the web on December 8, 1993. "Think of it as a map to the buried treasures of the information age," read the first line. But the map the writer was referring to, one he would spend the first half of the article describing, wasn't the World Wide Web. It was its most popular browser, a browser called Mosaic. Mosaic was created, in part, by Marc Andreessen. Like many of the early web pioneers, Andreessen is a man of lofty ambition. He is drawn to big ideas and grand statements. He once said that software will eat the world. In college, he was known for being far more talkative than your average software engineer, chatting it up about the next big thing. Andreessen has had a decades-long passion for technology. Years later, he would capture the imagination of the public with the world's first commercial browser, Netscape Navigator. He would grace the cover of Time magazine. He would become a cornerstone of Silicon Valley, defining its rapid ship-first-think-later ethos for years, and seek and capture his fortune in the world of venture capital. But Mosaic's story does not begin with a commanding legend of Silicon Valley overseeing, for better or worse, the future of technology. It begins with a restless college student. When Sir Tim Berners-Lee posted the initial announcement about the web, about a year before the article in the New York Times, Andreessen was an undergraduate at the University of Illinois. While he attended school, he worked at the university-affiliated computing lab known as the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, NCSA. NCSA occupied a similar space as ARPA in that they were both state-sponsored projects without an explicit goal other than to further the science of computing. If you worked at NCSA, it was possible to move from project to project without arousing too much suspicion from the higher-ups. Andreessen was supposed to be working on visualization software, which he had found a way to run mostly on autopilot. In his spare time, Andreessen would ricochet around the office, listening to everyone about what it was they were interested in. It was during one of those sessions that a colleague introduced him to the World Wide Web. He was immediately taken aback. He downloaded the Viola WWW browser, and within a few days, he had decided that the web would be his primary focus. He decided something else, too. He needed to make a browser of his own. In 1992, browsers could be cumbersome software. They lacked the polish and the conventions of modern browsers without decades of learning to build off of. They were difficult to download and install, often requiring users to make modifications to system files. And early browser makers were so focused on developing the web, they didn't think much about the visual interface of their software. Andreessen wanted to build a well-designed, performant, easy-to-install browser while simultaneously building on the features that Way was adding to the Viola WWW browser. He pitched his idea to a programmer at NCSA, Eric Bina. "Mark's a very good salesman," Bina would later recall, so he joined up. Taking their cue from the pace of others, Andreessen and Bina finished the first version of the Mosaic browser in just a few weeks. It was available for ex-Windows computers. To announce the browser, Andreessen posted a download link to the WWW Talk mailing list with the message, "By the power vested in me by nobody in particular, alpha/beta versions of 0.5 of NCSA's motif-based network information systems and World Wide Web browser, X-Mosaic, is hereby released." The web got more than just a popular browser. It got its first pitchman. The first version of the browser was impressive in a somewhat crowded field. To be sure, it had forms and some media support early on, but it wasn't the best browser, nor was it the most advanced browser. Instead, Andreessen and Bina focused on something else entirely. Mosaic set itself apart because it was the easiest to use. The installation process was simple, and the interface was, relatively speaking, intuitive. The Mosaic browser's secret weapon was its iteration. Before long, other programmers at NCSA wanted in on the project. They parceled off different operating systems to port the browser to. One team took the Mac, another Windows. By the fall of 1993, a few months after its initial release, Mosaic had feature-paired versions on Mac, Windows, and Unix systems, as well as compatible server software. After that, the pace of development only accelerated. Beta versions were released often and were available to download via FTP. New features were added at a rapid pace, and new versions seemed to ship every week. The NCSA Mosaic was fully engaged with the web community, active in the WWW Talk mailing list, talking with users and gathering bug reports. It was not at all unusual to submit a bug report and hear back a few hours later from an NCSA programmer with a fix. Andreessen was a particularly active presence, posting to threads almost daily. When the Mosaic team decided they might want to collect anonymous analytics about browser usage, Andreessen polled the WWW Talk list to see if it was a good idea. When he got a lot of questions about how to use HTML, he wrote a guide for beginners. When one Mosaic user posted some issues he was having, it led to a tense back and forth between that user and Andreessen. He claimed he wasn't a customer, and Andreessen shouldn't care too much about what he thought. Andreessen replied, "We do care what you think simply because having the wonderful distributed beta team that we essentially have due to this group gives us the opportunity to make our product much better than it could be otherwise." What Andreessen understood better than any of the early browser makers was that Mosaic was a product, and feedback from his users could drive its development. If they kept the feedback loop tight, they could keep the interface clean and bug-free while staying on the cutting edge of new features. It was the programming parable, "Given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow," come to life in browser development. There was an electricity to Mosaic development at NCSA. Internal competition fueled OS teams to get features out the door. Sometimes the Mac version would get to something first. Sometimes it was Binna and Andreessen continuing to work on X-Mosaic. We would get together middle of the night and come up with some cool idea. Images was an example of that. Then we would go off and race and see who would do it first, creator of the Windows version of Mosaic, John Mittelhauser later recalled. Sometimes the features were duds and would hardly go anywhere at all. Other times, as Mittelhauser points out, they were absolutely essential. In the months after launch, they started to surpass the feature list of even their nearest competitor, Viola WWW. They added forms support and rich media. They added bookmarks for users to keep track of their links. They even created their own What's New page, updated every single day, which tracked the web's most popular links. When you opened up Mosaic, the NCSA's What's New page was the first thing you saw. They weren't just building a browser, they were building a window to the web. As Mittelhauser points out, it was the image tag which became Mosaic's defining feature. It succeeded in doing two things. The tag was added without input from Sir Tim Berners-Lee or the wider community. Andreessen posted a note to WWW Talk only after it had been already implemented. So firstly, that set the Mosaic team in a conflict with other browser makers and some parts of the web community that would last for years. Secondly, it made Mosaic infinitely more popular. The image tag allowed for images to be embedded directly inline in the Mosaic browser. People found the web boring to browse. It was sterile, rigid, and scientific. Inline images changed all that. Within a few months, a new class of web designer was beginning to experiment with what was possible with images on the web. In some ways, it was the tag that made the web famous. The image tag prompted the feature in the New York Times and a subsequent write-up in Wired. By the time the press got around to talking about the web, Mosaic was the most popular browser and became a surrogate for the larger web world. Mosaic was to browsing the web as Google is to searching now. Ultimately, the higher-ups got involved. NCSA was not a tech company. They were a supercomputing lab. They came in to help make the Mosaic browser more cohesive and maybe more profitable. Licenses were parceled out to a dozen or so companies. Mosaic was bundled into Spry's Internet in a Box product. It was embedded in enterprise software by the Santa Cruz operation. In the end, Mosaic split off into two directions. Pressure from management pushed Andreessen to leave and start a new company. It would be called Netscape. Another of the licensees of the software was a company called Spyglass. They were beginning to have talks with Microsoft. Both would ultimately choose to rewrite the Mosaic browser from scratch for different reasons. Yet that browser would be their starting point, and their products would have lasting implications on the browser market for decades as the world began to see its first commercial browsers.
All right, thank you again, Jeremy. That was awesome. So And thank you, Jay, for writing that as well. So, and maybe we'll have y'all on one of these days, one of these days. So. Chris, did you have anything else you'd like to say here?
I don't think I have any part of them other than chopdocshow.com.